I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, in partnership with our colleagues at Side Effects, we're going to continue our ongoing community conversation about public health. We're going to talk about the bridge, which may or may not be a way to ease the pain suffered by people going through opioid withdrawal. My guests are Jake Harper of Side Effects Public Media, Indiana University Maurer School of Law Professor Jody Madera, and Dr. Andrew Chambers of the Indiana University School of Medicine. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881, email nolimits@wfyi.org, Facebook is No Limits WFYI, Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. Today on No Limits, we're going to continue our community conversation about important public health issues. Today we're going to be talking about the bridge, which may or may not be a way that medical professionals can ease the pain suffered by people going through opioid withdrawal. If you want to join this important conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are Jake Harper of Side Effects, returning to the show, public media, Indiana University Maurer School of Law Professor Jody Madera, also a veteran of the program.
Hello.
And Dr. Andrew Chambers of the Indiana University School of Medicine, who also has been here before. So
it's
like homecoming week here at No Limits. So let's start first foundationally. Jake, could you talk a little bit about what the bridge is?
Yeah, so the bridge is it's a nerve stimulator. It's a small little device that attaches behind your ear. And it attaches to your ear through a series of wires and small needles, and it delivers an electrical pulse. In theory, that pulse is designed to mitigate pain, and for the bridge, it's now been given an indication to help with opioid withdrawals. And that's unique to this particular nerve stimulator. And we should say that the opioid withdrawal symptoms are things like nausea, body aches, pain, and diarrhea is a really common symptom, cold sweats, hot sweats. So it's really miserable, and it would be great to find things that can help ease those symptoms. So the FDA cleared this device to help with those symptoms. But clearance is not the same thing as approval. I think a lot of people have gotten confused over this. So approval is a much higher, it requires a much higher standard of evidence, whereas clearance is unique to medical devices rather than drugs, and it's not the same standard that's used to reach approval. Really, all it says is that this device is safe and that it could work, but it doesn't necessarily show that it does work. So that clearance for this device, it turns out, was granted based largely on a single study. And that study has been sort of the focus of my reporting for the last several months.
Dr. Chambers, it sounds like there is a need for something like this. Whether this or not works, that the demand to help people through this period is pretty great.
It really is. Opiate withdrawal is really torture for people to suffer through. It affects so many body systems, and it just feels really bad. It goes on for days and days. But I think one important point, though, about that is that withdrawal itself is not the basis of addiction, right? We know there are plenty of severe addictions, like just take nicotine. A lot of people can identify with that type of addiction. There's very little withdrawal with that. But that addiction is very severe, and you're compelled to use the drug with or without a withdrawal syndrome. So I think that what's important to know is that withdrawal is important to treat, but it's not necessarily core to treating the addiction. It certainly is a, humane thing to do, and it can also help get people on to more definitive treatments for opiate addiction. So it definitely, one way or the other, you have to go through withdrawal to get on a medication called naltrexone. Mm-hmm. That's one of our better treatments for opiate addiction.
So, Judy, I'm trying to set the table here for the discussion that's going to follow. What are the legal and sort of policy-driven issues involved here?
Well, I think the key one is, what do you do when you're actually doing this quote-unquote research, right? Mm-hmm. What do you tell people who are experiencing opioid withdrawal symptoms about the device? What do you tell them about what it's going to be like, what they're going to go through, proper safeguards? And more importantly, what should the consequences be if that somehow does not take place?
We are talking about a new device called the Bridge, which may or may not be a way to help people through the painful process of opioid withdrawal. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You also can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. So, Jody, I'm going to stay with you for a second, but I want to hear everybody's thoughts on this. Part of what's going on here is because the opioid epidemic has become so huge, there's a lot of money involved in trying to find ways through this process for people. Can we talk a little bit about, we've sort of outlined what the human costs are, trying to help people through what sounds like just an absolutely excruciating period. Mm-hmm. But there are also tremendous financial interests involved here, correct?
Correct. So one of the key beneficiaries of a device like the Bridge would be any medication for which you had to go through withdrawal or detoxification to get on that medication. I'm thinking here of Vivitrol. And in fact, one of the authors of the study that Jake was talking about earlier filed a patent for neuromodulation devices plus just kind of the protocol they would use to transition someone to Vivitrol. And he's a paid spokesperson for Vivitrol. So obviously that's one key interest that is very obvious here, right? There are a number of drugs that one does not have to go through detoxification to get on, but there seems to be this intrinsic link between the Bridge device and this drug called Vivitrol. And another human cost is just, one might say, the cost of doing this research, right? So it costs money to do a good study. It costs money to protect people's interests. And that money is always well spent if a device is effective.
Dr. Chambers, I'd like you to amplify on the point a little bit. I mean, how much is at stake here? How many people are we talking about in Indiana and the United States who are dealing with opioid problems right now?
Well, we don't have a precise handle on the number of people with opioid addiction because it's hard to a little bit hard to diagnose on a population level. But it's gotten so large. Estimates between 1-4% of the population, somewhere in that ballpark. And if you look at it in different ways, in terms of the impact, just overdoses alone have become the single leading cause of death for Americans under 50 years old. Just the overdose, and there's lots of ways to die from opiate addiction besides overdose. The economic cost. There's a recent study just in Indiana alone, up to billions of dollars per year. For just our state is the economic cost of the epidemic. So, it's really unprecedented, and the scope of the epidemic, the human cost, the economic cost, and to realize that it was basically propagated by the medical system itself is astonishing. And so I think there is incredible urgency both by the healthcare system, our political leadership, to do something decisive to turn this thing around because it's so, devastating, but also rather appalling. So, of course, there's gotten to be a lot of, real interest and money flowing into solving this problem. I think, though, that the hazards of this is that, you can kind of think about one of the root causes of the epidemic is a generalized lack of science, a lack of professional expertise, has kind of given rise to the epidemic, right? And so what bothers me a bit about this is that we're not really addressing those root causes. So when there's a sudden rush of frankly, a lot of media attention, a lot of political attention, a lot of money flowing in, you know, it sets up the opportunity for all kinds of quick fix solutions.
And I didn't want to interrupt because the stuff you were saying was important, but I do think we got to drive home those numbers. If it's between 1 and 4%, and those are low, nationally then, by my math, that's between 3.3 million and slightly more than 13 million Americans. Is that correct? If we assume 330 million
that's
people in the
country.
That's how I
hear it. That sounds about right. Yeah.
Okay. So who are the major players involved here, Jake? What is your reporting shown there?
So major players. So you've got, so this company that makes the bridge device, it's called Innovative Health Solutions, and they're an Indiana-based company. So they're relatively small. They're based out of Versailles. And they've been sort of pushing this device, at least in Indiana and in other states as well, for the past couple of years. The major players are really sort of that company. The other company involved, which was mentioned before, is Alkermes, which makes Vivitrol, which is this other drug. They're not, as far as my reporting is found, I haven't found that they're directly involved in this. But even the name the bridge suggests is that it's a bridge to
Vivitrol.
Yeah,
it doesn't exist
treatment.
By itself. A bridge leads from one place to another and carries you through something. So let me ask this because, and I think all three of you have kind of alluded to this, is also the political pressure involved. There is now real pressure to try to find fixes to this problem. And I'll start with Jody on this one. Because at least there is some perception out there that the political class and state government, federal government, were a little late to the party here in responding to this crisis, particularly here in Indiana. How much of that is a factor in trying to find what Dr. Chambers referred to as a quick fix solution?
Well, I think there's been a lot of people who have written and who have addressed those disparities, right? It's not like opioids weren't a problem for decades in this country. They have been. But when politicians' families themselves became affected, right, people started paying attention. When people who didn't usually succumb to substance use disorder problems began to be visible in the news, then it became a problem. So I think it's been very visible here in Indiana. And I think some state legislators have felt pressure to kind of pass quick legislation or to look for a quick fix like the bridge device.
How much of the political pressure is at work here, Jake? What's your reporting, Sean?
So at least as far as the bridge is concerned, what I found was that Brian Carrico, the president of Innovative Health Solutions, went to the legislature in August of 2016, so this was a couple years ago, and he was pushing information about the bridge. Some of it was factual, some of it was not. And what happened after that, according to some people I spoke with, was that there was pressure from lawmakers to get Indiana Medicaid to start paying for this device. The device costs, I believe, $600 per device. And there are drugs that do similar things out there that are much cheaper. So it should be said that's sort of an issue in all this. But Indiana Medicaid is supposed to cover things that don't have a solid evidence base and don't have an indication from the FDA for certain purposes. So that was some of the work that was going on behind the scenes.
Dr. Chambers, what kind of strains does it place on the medical profession, to have to deal with a situation like this that, obviously is a public health problem and carries its own sort of medical challenges, but you also then have the challenge of this political pressure being exerted as well?
Well, absolutely. I think that, the cost of the epidemic is so far reaching. It actually, causes the misappropriation, maybe misuse of some types of medical care. It actually increases certain types of medical care. It increase, you know, the criminal justice costs, et cetera, et cetera. And I think what's important is that, you know, in our medical system, in Western medicine, science needs to drive diagnosis and treatment, because if you're not driving it through science, then what else is driving it? And it turns into greed and politics. So science has got to be the foundation, and has been, in our medical system.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about the bridge, which may be or may not be a way to help people through opioid withdrawal. My guests are Jake Harper of Side Effects Public Media, Indiana University School of Law Professor Jody Madera, and Dr. Andrew Chambers of the Indiana University School of Medicine. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today as part of our continuing community conversation about public health that we do in partnership with our colleagues at Side Effects Public Media. We're talking about the bridge, which is a new device that may or may not help people who are suffering through opioid withdrawal through that process. My guests are Jake Harper of Side Effects Public Media, who's done some great reporting on this, Indiana University Maurer School of Law Professor Jody Lene Madera, and Dr. Andrew Chambers of the Indiana University School of Medicine. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Lindsay has done, and give us a call at 866-476-3881.
I like the patches.
Hi, Lindsay. Oh, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I was wondering, my husband and I have been on Suboxone for 8 to 10 years, and it saved our lives. It really did. It has done its job. But none of the Suboxone providers take you off of the Suboxone gently. They step you down, and even coming off of 2 milligrams of Suboxone is very hard. It's agony. I don't understand why more doctors don't prescribe Ultram or Librium during that process. And I was wondering about that.
Thanks very much for the call and the question. It's a good thing we've got a doctor in the room who can answer your question. Thanks again, Lindsay.
Great.
Thank you.
Hi.
Dr. Chambers.
Hi. Yeah, so that is a really, really good question. So I think a couple things to think about. One is that, you know, Ultram is another opioid. So, you know, it's the reason we wouldn't use that one is because if you're tapering down very, you know, slowly on Suboxone, which I agree, if your goal is to taper it down, you ought to, you know, a doctor and a patient all work together to do that, you know, carefully and slowly. There's not an emergency if they've been stable. So you taper it slowly. So anyway, you're not going to use another, you're going to put another opiate in the mix when you're tapering an opiate, because that's... you know, it's just simpler to stay on the same opiate and merely just taper it. With a Librium, that's a benzodiazepine medication. And the problem there is that a huge component of the opioid overdose problem is related to people who are mixing opioids and benzodiazepines, because that combination can be readily lethal. So we don't want to use a different class of controlled substance with an opiate to exert a detoxification or a withdrawal treatment, or to taper someone from an opiate, because it's just an unacceptable risk-benefit ratio. The one caveat to that is an inpatient unit. But guess what? We don't have nearly enough inpatient units that are linked to outpatient services. So this is a huge gap in our treatment infrastructure, that we do not have adequate linkages between inpatient and outpatient services, and they really ought to be kind of working together, maybe even part of the same system, but that's an incredibly rare, there's very few, if any, examples of that in Indiana, where you can link supervised inpatient detoxification withdrawal with an outpatient program. The other thing I would say about this that I'm kind of hearing in her question, that's also a real problem, is that there are camps, you know, there's actually a competition and, you know, some people even call it a commercial war going on between the advocates for one treatment versus the advocates for another, you know, and these are very much, you know, there are political lines drawn on this. There's kind of a, you know, a criminal justice camp. There's kind of an American Society of Addiction Medicine camp, where, you know, people fight about which treatment is better. And this is really unfortunate. I mean, you can imagine it's kind of like, imagine a bunch of oncologists fighting each other about which chemotherapy is better, when the truth is that different individuals need different treatments, and every expert treatment system ought to have all the tools at their disposal to individualize the care to what individual patients need. The problem with that is that it takes time and expertise, which we're not doing a great job of allowing for.
How much of this is also, I'm going to stay with you for a second, Dr. Chambers, on this. How much of this is also the fact that, you know, there is a desire when you're dealing with the kind of, first, the, you know, life-threatening problems of opioid addiction, and then it sounds like the absolute miserable experience of going through withdrawal, there is a tremendous temptation to try to look for a magic bullet when, in fact, you know, once you are addicted, many of the solutions just will not be pain-free or discomfort-free at the very least.
That's right. That's right. I mean, you know, our healthcare system, I mean, again, you know, this is an example, I think, of where the root causes of the opioid epidemic are still in place and are actually preventing us from addressing the epidemic in the deeper, long-term ways that we need to address it. And, you know, we're learning much more about the nature of chronic pain. We're, you know, that it's much more of a central nervous system problem. It's much more of a neuropsychiatric problem than we might have realized a decade ago. We're learning much more about the limits of opiates in all this. We're learning much more that, you know, our healthcare system has been very focused on a business model of making money, quite frankly. And one way you make money is to make anything you do as pleasant as possible with patients, which I get, you know, I'm a patient too. And you want your treatment to be as, you want everything to be as easy and pain-free as possible. But, you know, there's a reason we experience pain, and there's a healthy dimension to pain. And there's a reason you don't want to get too many surgeries and too many procedures done.
Jake, how did you find this story? I mean, what led you to it?
So the bridge has been a topic of conversation, at least in Indiana, for the last couple of years, maybe even longer, I'm trying to think. So I'd been hearing about it for a while. There's a court in Greenwood that incorporated it into their drug court last year. One of the major hospital chains around here started using it. Politicians have been talking about it at the state level and in other states. So you know, there's been a lot of enthusiasm for this device well before the November 2017 FDA clearance for it. And I should say that, like, a lot of this enthusiasm, it hinges around this this issue that Andy was talking about, which is like this sort of battle between the medications. So just generally, I don't think we've done this yet, but there are three medications that are FDA approved to treat opioid addiction. One is methadone, which is an opioid. Another is buprenorphine, which the caller alluded to in the form of Suboxone, which is a brand name, which is also an opioid. And then there's Vivitrol or naltrexone, which is not an opioid. So there are people out there who prefer Vivitrol because it's not an opioid. It doesn't maintain you on an opioid. And those people, some of them are lawmakers, some of them are drug court judges, and those people also have been pretty enthusiastic supporters of the bridge device because of its ability to connect people, supposed ability to connect people to Vivitrol treatment. So the study informing the FDA clearance of the bridge device, I went in looking for – I just wanted to do a story about what are the limitations of this study because – the study itself is pretty small, it turns out. There are only 73 patients that they're pointing to, and there's no control. So they didn't compare the bridge device to anything else. So there's really no way to know if it actually works or if it's a placebo effect, which people talk about all the time. So that was sort of what I went in finding. And then as I kept going and kept talking to people, it just kept raising more questions, which came down to issues of like the validity and the ethics of the study itself.
Jody, I saw you nodding your head through all of that. What led you to developing an interest in this?
Well, actually, I read the study and I noticed that a colleague and I noticed that there are a lot of issues raised just by reading the document. And for example, it talks about how 8 clinics suddenly started using this off-label treatment according to a pretty detailed protocol, but there was no mention of how the protocol was started, and it seemed unusual that these clinics would start, you know, such a controlled, what's basically a controlled study, without some coordination. And it also mentioned that they did not seek permission from the participants in the study because they got their medical records afterward through something called a retrospective medical records review. So again, if these eight clinics are essentially doing the same thing, following this very detailed protocol, how did this get started? Those are some questions I had.
Yeah, I should say the questions that were raised as I did my reporting, a lot of them came from Jody and one of her colleagues as I was reporting the rest of the story out.
And found all of that. We are talking about the bridge today on No Limits, which might or might not be a way to help people through the process of opioid withdrawal by masking or easing the pain associated with that process. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Randolph has done and send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. I'm going to massacre this because I'm always horrible at medical nomenclature. Is it clonidine?
Clonidine.
Clonidine controls opioid withdrawal symptoms. We use this in chemical dependency units since 1990s. Probably ought to talk first, Dr. Chambers, about what that is.
Yes, that's right. So clonidine was one of our great examples of basic neuroscience pointing us to a viable treatment for an addictive-related disorder. And what was known in the late 1990s, and this is work done at Yale University, was that clonidine settles down a brain region that gets overexcited when you're in opiate withdrawal. And it's also a blood pressure medication. But in the context of opiate withdrawal, it calms down a brain area that produces many, not all, but many of the symptoms that go along with opiate withdrawal. And that was worked out actually in laboratory rats, and they moved into the clinic, and sure enough, it gave comfort to people suffering through opiate withdrawal. That's been around for a long time and widely used. The drug was already on the market for a different indication. It was studied for opiate withdrawal in many studies over the years, and so it's become a mainstay. So it's a bona fide treatment. Just recently, the FDA actually approved of another medication that's an analog of clonidine called lofexidine. And it also has a similar mechanism of action, takes away the jitters, calms your heart rate a bit, has a little bit of a subjective relaxing effect. So again, treats many of the, not all, but many of the components of severe opiate withdrawal.
How much of this is also the fact that, you know, it sounds like just as I am listening to you here, I'm thinking if you are a doctor keeping track of all of that, or much less a patient, is a time-consuming, almost mind-numbing task here. I'm trying to figure out, you know, how these drugs might interact with each other, whether you're creating additional problems along the way. Is part of the appeal of this been that you really don't have to think about this? I mean, it sounds almost like something out of a science fiction movie. You put a device just behind your ear, as I understand it, correct, Jake?
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, you feel better, right? That's sort of the appeal of it.
Yeah, that's the appeal. But
and you don't have to worry about any of the other interactions or anything like that, or creating new chemical dependencies or anything like that.
Yeah, I should also say I didn't get into the specifics of what my story found, but you know that is the appeal of the device.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that they didn't have to report by labeling the study a retrospective review, what they left out was something called a dropout rate, how many people didn't make it through the experiment. And what I found from talking to the providers who were involved in this experiment is that a lot of people don't make it through. They get the device on, they leave the clinic, and then some of them never come back. And some people who are initially assessed for the device in the beginning, so before they come in for an appointment, they're going to get the device in a few days once they've started to withdraw. Some of those people never make it back either. So there's a huge portion of people that don't make it through and that were never reported in that study with the bridge. And I think that's a question that has sort of yet to be addressed in all this.
What does that do to the validity of the study, Jody?
Well, that can actually greatly diminish the validity of the study. I mean, if you're not reporting these, then you really don't have a clear picture of what's going on in the actual trial itself.
So what are the parameters? And I'll throw this to Dr. Chambers, but I'd like Jody's thoughts as well. For a legitimate study of something like this, one in which we could assume that the findings are at least somewhat definitive, what would that kind of study look like?
Well, you know, it would really have three main ingredients, which are not present in the study we're talking about. And one main ingredient is that you have a comparison. You could use a standard of care. You know, you could compare it to clonidine. So compare the bridge to clonidine. You might compare it to a fake treatment. But that really is the most crucial element of a solid study. So a second thing is that you randomize the subjects to one or the other treatment. A third component is you kind of want people to be blind. You want the givers of the treatment and the patients to not be sure which treatment they're getting, so that the power of suggestion can't influence the results. I think one of the concerns I have, you know, about the process that the FDA clearance was given and you know, based on this study that didn't have those adequate controls. But also the way the FDA clearance was announced by the company itself is as follows. I can directly quote the FDA press release by Innovative Health Solutions. And it says, quote, "The device helps take away the fear of withdrawal and leads to a much higher success rate." So here you have the company marketing the FDA clearance. The thing is, it says device takes away the fear. There's never been a scientific study that the device takes away fear. Number two, it says and leads to a much higher success rate. When you say a higher success rate, you mean in comparison to something else, and that has never been done. So they are using false information in their FDA press release right there.
I think when we come back, I'm going to go to Jody on that one to talk about what the legal implications might be. We're talking about the bridge today on No Limits. My guests are Jake Harper of Side Effects Public Media, Indiana University Maurer School of Law Professor Jody Madera, and Dr. Andrew Chambers of the Indiana University School of Medicine. I am John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today on No Limits as part of our ongoing community conversation about public health that we do in partnership with our colleagues at Side Effects Public Media about a new device called the Bridge, which might be, might not be, a way to ease the pain suffered by people who are going through opioid withdrawal. My guests are Jake Harper of Side Effects Public Media, Indiana University Maurer School of Law Professor Jody Madera, and Dr. Andrew Chambers of the Indiana University School of Medicine. Before we went to the break, Dr. Chambers had pointed out that some of the claims advanced for this device sort of overstated where the research was had taken the research that had taken place so far and what that might be that might demonstrate. I said we were going to talk with Jody, who's a law professor, about what the legal implications are for this, about, you know, advancing claims that have not yet been demonstrated.
Well, that's actually called misrepresentation in the law, but unfortunately it's a pretty tough legal claim to prove. And, of course, you then have to prove that somebody, for example, the company misled providers who then prescribed. So it's a long chain. It's a very long process to establish those types of things. But there is also other requirements that the FDA has, for example, that ethical human subjects regulations are fulfilled. And if it turns out that a company is not following, for example, IRB oversight regulations or getting exemptions from informed consent regulations, then that also leads us to question the study results for another reason.
So, Jake, let me ask this. You know, given that this, and we probably ought to emphasize that while the research may not prove conclusively that the device works, it also has not demonstrated that it does not work, right? So the whole thing is still somewhat in question. Is there anyone else looking at this device and investigating whether the claims might be true?
So the company would say yes, according to my interviews with them. However, in trying to report out what was actually going on as far as current research, I came up kind of empty-handed. I was told that there were two ongoing studies, and if you know, clinical trials are posted online at clinicaltrials.gov. Like, there's a website for them, and there is, at least last I checked, I don't believe there was any ongoing research. I believe there were some past studies that were, there was one that was discontinued, but I hadn't seen any actual registered clinical trials to look at this device.
Is there any pushback, you know, from the health insurance industry on this? Because part of what I'm wondering, and this is probably more of my personal life than I normally would share, but I'm diabetic, and periodically I will find out that my health insurance carrier will sort of override the prescribed medication that my doctor has prescribed and say instead, no, we'd prefer you take this unless, because obviously they think it's cheaper or there's a better deal they've struck with the provider. I'm wondering, you know, if insurance companies are covering this in any way, if they're not saying, you know, show us some results or we're not going to sign off on paying $600 for this thing. Jody.
Well, insurance companies can only cover evidence-based treatment, and certainly the FDA clearance would open up the door to that. But at this point, I don't think that they're covering this device here in Indiana. And we have to be careful when examining the difference between insurance company policies, which often favor paying the cheapest provider from the law, right? Mm-hmm. Which just demands this evidence basis and medical necessity.
Dr. Chambers, your thoughts?
Well, I'm just looking at the, you know, the same press release from Innovative Health Solutions announcing the FDA clearance, and the last line in their press release is, this FDA clearance makes the device eligible for insurance coverage as soon as states and commercial carriers adopt the technology.
I should say I reported this out a little bit more than what ended up in the story, and I also was told that several state Medicaid agencies were pursuing this option, considering covering it, and that some, I think I was told, would be covering it very soon. And it, at least last I checked, that had not happened. And when I reached out to those states that were mentioned to me, they were several of a few. There were only a few total, but some of those said that they were not actually actively considering it.
Dr. Chambers, I mean, part of the reason we struggle with our health care debates in this country, and they're so vicious, is that they represent, what, 20% of the economy, something like
that.
That's right. It's a huge, aside from the human costs and consequences, there's this whole other piece. Is the lobbying on this sort of stuff always this intense when there are new products or new devices or new drugs?
I don't believe it is always this intense. I think that, you know, there's a lot of politics and a lot of emotion around the opioid epidemic. You know, this gets deep into what mental health and behavioral health care should be and how it's lacking. It gets into, is our criminal justice system operating as it should? It gets into medical economics. It gets into the desperation and loss of people in your family who are sick and dying. It gets, you know, it bundles all that up. And the fact that this epidemic was actually, you know, caused by a healthcare system that has not embraced addictionology and is arguably exacerbated by a criminal justice system that wants to criminalize a brain disease. You know, this is a potent fuel for a very emotional and politically charged topic.
Jody and Jake, how much of this is also, at least here in Indiana, fueled by the fact that it's an Indiana-based company?
Well, I think certainly politicians want to help support the economy. They want to make sure that, for example, proper alliances are built between major hospital chains in Indiana and Indiana companies. So I think there was a lot of incentive here to hype up devices like the Bridge.
Jake.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I think one of the lines I heard with this is that this is an Indiana solution to a national problem, I think, is sort of the line that I've heard. And I can't recall actually whether that was from the company or someone else, but that I think that that idea has sort of taken hold here for
sure. Well, if it was from a legislator, I doubt he or she thought of it spontaneously. So you know, in terms of this, what steps are there, you know, since, you know, right now all we've got with this device are a lot of questions, right? You know, let's start this process all over again. What are the steps we ought to be taking? I'll start with Jody on this answer some of those questions.
Sure. I think we need to start with a proper study with the requirements that Dr. Chambers described. And I think that needs to be a study that incorporates proper ethics, ethical oversight. And I think that that would allow us to have a lot more trust in the results.
Who would do that kind of study? Dr. Chambers.
Well, you need teams of clinical investigators who, know how to do this and understand the disease and that are experienced in these kinds of clinical trials, but also people who are not really invested in either a positive or negative result. That's really important. They want to find the truth. They're not there to, particularly get rich or appeal to a political angle.
Or just make payroll, if
right.
Not get rich, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Jody.
I should mention that one of the doctors on the study actually had a hand in designing the device, which is not improper, but then failed to disclose a conflict of interest that doctor later had after he had applied for a patent on devices like the Bridge, plus the protocol of a, you know, transferring to a pharmaceutical afterwards, but then did not disclose it to the article or to the journal.
The journal since corrected that.
Yes.
In April, after I asked some questions to them.
Yes.
But, yeah.
But it raised the specter of a conflict of interest.
So is there any appetite out there, Jake, as your reporting shown that this thing is going to be studied in the manner that Jody and Dr. Chambers are talking about?
Honestly, I don't know. I mean, I had heard from the company that there were some studies in the works, but again, like trying to report that out, I didn't find anything. And then going back to the company for more specific information, they declined to provide any.
Jody.
And IHS is not the only one that's working on this type of technology either. In fact, I'm aware of some deep brain stimulation research that is going on right now. So there are certainly other options out there for testing these types of therapies.
Probably ought to ask, if it is determined ultimately that this thing doesn't really work, that it creates something like a placebo effect or even that the effects, I think some of Jake's reporting suggested that at least with some of the people who were studied, they'd put it on, they'd use it, and at first they felt fine and then found that the effects kind of wore off after a couple of days, and withdrawal obviously goes on much longer than that. If, in fact, it proves that this is not effective, what are the costs to the system and to the people involved? I'll start with Dr. Chambers, but I'd like everybody's thoughts on that.
Well, I think it depends on how effective the marketing of the device is without there being evidence. How big does it get? Do insurance carriers, really pick it up? Do people demand it? I've had patients approach me asking for it. And, what I say to them is my obligation is to provide you the best that I know science tells us to do, and it's not there here on this one. Might it be one day? Sure. And that's not just the bridge device. People are asking for, how about some cannabidiol for my anxiety and depression? And I'll tell them, it's a promising area of science, but we need science to tell us, and it's not there yet. So no, I'm not going to prescribe that, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that, what we see now is like this is actually was posted on the internet on June 13, 2018. So this is fully, 7 months after the original FDA clearance of the device. So this is on a website called FDA Daily that announces activities in the FDA. So here's what the headline is from this website. It says, the FDA has cleared an auricular neurostimulation device to help symptoms of opioid withdrawal, including cravings, agitation, anxiety, and depression. So think about, it's almost like a barnyard gossip effect. So now they're even blowing this into indications that are way off track. And maybe the next website now says it's for depression and the next website for anxiety. So it just really blossoms. And, what's forgotten here is, where's the science? And if you start that's, I think, what's disturbed me the most about this whole thing is that we need science to guide our medical practice. If you don't have that, you're going to have something else guide it. And if you don't have science, if you run a system that doesn't rely on science, then you're going to have other things drive it. And, I think what's disturbing to me about this, here we have this FDA clearance, the horse is out of the barn, the science is not there. And so are we going to head down that road? And am I going to prescribe drugs that are not scientifically backed out of my clinic? If I start doing that, why do we need science? Why do we need science at all? Why don't we just have people in power tell us what treatment is? Why don't we just have better, marketing campaigns to determine what treatment is? Why don't we have politicians of one party or the other tell us what medical care should be? It's a scary thing that we have to protect against.
Jody.
Well, I think we're living in a post-truth society in many ways, where we hear regularly about fake news. And on the other hand, consumers are not just people who go and shop at a big department store, but they're also people who shop for healthcare-related choices and decisions. And I think we're all under increasing pressure, right, to look at things like Dr. Chambers was just talking about, the marketing, listen to the politicians. But trust in governmental institutions like the FDA, trust in science is what is needed more now than ever before. And if we have studies like this that leave us questioning their legitimacy, if we have FDA-type agencies that leave us questioning their gatekeeping skills, then that leaves us as healthcare consumers in a much poorer position than we were before.
Jake, part of it is also there is a real hunger to try to solve this problem. You've done a lot of reporting on the opioid epidemic.
Sure.
The people who are suffering with this are really desperate.
Yeah. And I think that's what brings people into the clinics that, you know, that also have the bridge or that have any kind of treatment, really. And I mean, one of the reasons I was interested in this from the get-go is that this treatment is not proven to work, but offering it to patients, especially in an experimental fashion, has consequences for those patients. If it doesn't work for them, if you don't follow up with them to find out whether it works, what could they have done in the meantime with that treatment opportunity? That was kind of the question that I went in asking is, you know, if they're given the bridge and it doesn't work for them, would they have done better on Suboxone? Would they have done better in an inpatient facility? Those aren't necessarily options for those people, but it was definitely like a driving question as I was moving through this.
We're getting close on time. I'm going to try to squeeze in one more phone call. Chris, you're on the air.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Certainly. You got about 30 seconds.
Okay. When I heard the topic, I was intrigued because given all the news of opioid addiction, I guess my question or comment is, with an Indiana company having the potential to develop a cure for this or at least a treatment for the symptoms, I would think this would be really positive, and the guests seem pretty negative on everything. What are the positives? How would the FDA even clear it? And did this company work with some of the life science expertise in our community to help them with the clinical trial process is my question.
Thanks very much for the call and the question. Jody.
Well, I think one of the reasons why I am so skeptical of this particular article is that they did not follow human subjects regulations. They did not seek informed consent, and so that throws the whole legitimacy of the article into doubt. If this device has the potential to be so effective, what did they have to lose by not following those particular regulations?
So, you know, in terms of this, and we should emphasize again, the study doesn't really demonstrate that this thing is effective. It also doesn't demonstrate yet that it wasn't effective. Part of the problem here is that we have questions and no answers. You know, Jake, where is your reporting going forward on this?
I'm sort of waiting to hear what happens at the journal. The journal has said that they're investigating this issue to see whether they should retract or not, because that's what happens when issues of validity are raised, is the journals look into these things and they either decide to retract an article or don't, or they run a correction. So that's kind of where I'm at with this at this point and following any developments that might occur at the FDA.
I feel like we could spend another hour on this at least, but I'd like to thank my guests, Jake Harper of Side Effects Public Media, Indiana University Maurer School of Law Professor Jody Madera, and Dr. Andrew Chambers of the Indiana University School of Medicine, for a provocative conversation. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.